Hey, everybody, and welcome to the NFL Roadshow, episode one of the 2022 offseason. And I'm here for it, eager to dive into all the things offseason related, free agency, draft, all of it. But first, though, we got to talk about that game, the one that inspired a massive celebration in my house. My husband and son, as I have said before, are both Rams fans. So that was extremely fun for me to watch them experience the game and celebration that ensued. I will say, however, the anxiety of the hours that led up to that Aaron Donald exclamation point play on fourth down were not the most fun that I've ever had. There was a lot of stress in my presence, but I know that's the way most of you, or at least a lot of you, experience football, so you probably get it. As for me, I am not necessarily a Rams fan, at least not in the way that most fans are, though I do have a ridiculous amount of respect for Les Snead in particular and the way that he's built that team and the way that he's been willing to challenge conventional thinking. I think he's very smart. I find his approach to team building to be very intriguing and much more layered and intentional than I think most people give him and the team credit for. I have said it before, I'll say it a million times more. Jordan Rodrigue has done a really good job of articulating what it is that they have actually done in terms of building this team and the ways in which it is not all in or Super Bowl or bust or mortgaging their future for their present or any of that stuff. And in fact, she did so brilliantly back in November when she came on this podcast. It was episode 100. So if you want to go back and listen to it, I think it's worth it. I actually just listened a couple of days ago to refresh my memory about the things that she had said about the way that they'd built this team, and everything was still relevant. And I think it will continue to be in the context of their Super Bowl win and the inevitable conversations that we're going to have in the next few weeks and months about the sustainability of their success. But again, not a big Rams fan here. I'm not really an NFL fan. We've had that discussion. I mean, I am an NFL fan. Good grief. I'm a huge NFL fan. I don't have a team. That's a separate conversation. I am, however, a proud Angeleno, right? I grew up in the LA market, though not exactly in LA. I was down in Orange County growing up, but I've lived in Los Angeles for most of my adult life, save for a couple of years when I left to go work in small TV markets, getting experience, that kind of thing. Since then, I've covered all the LA teams. And in that way, I'm thrilled that LA has a Super Bowl champion. I enjoyed the game in that sense and the Rams' success in that sense. I also loved the halftime show in that sense, right? For a million reasons. My son has been playing Family Affair by Mary J. Blige on a loop since that game. And I kind of love that that is the song that he fell in love with. But the whole thing was amazing. And I know a bunch of people felt pride in the show for a bunch of different reasons. And I love that. For me, it was just so LA. Like, Snoop's wide-ranging NFL fandom is well-documented, but that guy is rooted deep in this community. Like, when I used to cover high schools, he would come to the Long Beach Poly games. I have a picture of me interviewing him at a state championship game. When I covered USC, he was there on the sidelines cheering on the Trojans, befriending Lindell White, famously. He is in it here. He's got that youth football league. So to see him up there, seawalking all over the stage with that smile on his face, I felt a great deal of unearned pride. Like, he and they represented my city so well. And that is actually something that I want to talk about before I bring in our guest, the wonderfully smart Warren Sharp. I want to talk about LA and the shit that this city gets about its fans, or lack of fans. And I get it. From an outsider's perspective, it doesn't look good. The parade route, not a good look. The TV ratings, same thing. LA market, not in the top 10 in terms of Super Bowl audiences. How is that possible when you're such a big market, when you have a team in the game? There are things that don't look good from the outside that I think are easier to understand from the inside. Some of the stereotypes about LA fans, I will not defend. We do go to games late, and we do leave early to beat traffic. I think, to a degree, the front-running thing is a little bit accurate, right? And I think that, and I'll raise my hand as somebody here that kind of does this with USC, there's a lot of stuff going on, right? There's a lot of things that you can do. I know people say that all the time about LA. when you have so many options, it kind of feels like as a team, as a fan, like you better make it worth my while. I don't have as much reason to continue to torture myself if you're not going to put any effort into the team to build a winner and kind of like pay it off for me as a fan. So I do think that we as a city approach sports in that way. And I know that other cities don't get that, don't appreciate that. And I think that that's valid. That's a valid critique of LA sports fans. But looking at the Rams specifically, I just don't think it's fair. I don't think you can look at the parade route. I don't think you can look at whether you saw enough Rams gear around town this past week. I don't think any of that's fair for a few reasons. And I just really quickly want to point out, like, hey, Philadelphia fans, you don't like people lazily bringing up the Santa Claus thing and painting your fan base with that brush, right? Cowboys fans don't like everybody pointing to them and saying, hey, you're front runners because you like the Cowboys, right? And just dismissing you as a fan. They're lazy and unfair stereotypes. They're probably rooted a little bit in something that's true for at least part of the fan base. The same is true here. But in terms of football, frankly, in terms of everything, I think LA has great sports fans. They are different sports fans than you see in other cities, though, for a number of reasons. One, and I think that this one's huge, this is a town of transplants. People here are from other places, more than I would imagine is the case in Kansas City or Green Bay or Pittsburgh. So just using the parents of my son's friends at school as an example. One of the dads is from Seattle. He's a diehard Seahawks fan. His wife is from Minnesota. She cheers for the Vikings. Another parent is from Wisconsin. He's a big Packers fan. One is from Boston, Patriots fan. We've got a Bengals fan in the mix. There was a boy at my son's school who cried when the Chiefs lost that day, the next day, when my husband walked up to him and goes, oh, I heard you were bummed about the Chiefs. Waterworks again. My point is, there are fans here. I promise. I know them. They're from other places, and they brought their allegiances with them. And that's fine. That's what our city is. It's a melting pot of all of that. That is the beauty of LA, in my opinion. And the people who did grow up in LA, they have teams too. They just picked them differently than kids in other cities did because for 20 years, we didn't have a team. So people latched on to teams from other cities, either because they were good the year that that person was impressionable as a kid or they had a good player. My husband's Rams fandom, it stems from Marshall Faulk. He loved him, so he cheered for his team. It had nothing to do with LA. They just happened to come to LA. They were in St. Louis when my husband decided to fall in love with them. They came to LA, by the way, 6 years ago. They've only been here for 6 years. Now think about your team and the way you feel about your team, and let's say the NFL sends your city the Falcons. What would the Falcons have to do to get you on board, to split your allegiance, or maybe win it over entirely? How long would that take? Would it take one good year? Would it take two good years? What would need to happen to take you away from the team that you already love and get you cheering in a way that feels like real fandom for the Falcons? Because that's what's happening here. You've got a friend that's a Seahawks fan, for example, who is now immersed in Rams excitement. That actually might be a bad example because the Seahawks hate the Rams, but you get the point I'm trying to make. Now, maybe he takes his kids to a couple of Rams games or Chargers games, and they win, and they're fun, and the kids start cheering for them, and maybe he softens a little down the line, and he starts cheering for both teams. Maybe the kids become specifically Rams or Chargers fans. It takes time. And so, no, we don't have a Rams fan base here that is ready to take off work and line the streets, because the fans here have not been waiting their whole lives for this moment. They haven't invested emotionally for long enough to go to that extreme. And by the way, they did take off work and line the streets for the Lakers and the Dodgers because they had invested emotionally in that way. It just takes time. The Rams know that. It's going to take more years like the year that they just had. Games and teams, that are capable of pulling people in. It's not the people, it's the situation. And I wish we'd stop framing it as if the fans here are less than. They're not. I also understand we're not going to stop framing it that way, because that seems to be the way everything is framed now. Some extreme either or. Stafford just won a Super Bowl. Is he now a Hall of Famer? Like, why are we having that conversation? Did I miss something here? Did he announce he was retiring? No? Okay. So he's going to add more to his resume? Okay. Are we going to take that into account in this Hall of Fame conversation? Whether what comes next is good or bad? Yes? Okay. Then can we chill out for now? No? Okay. Joe Burrow. Is he the best in the AFC? Where did that even come from this week? I mean, again, can he just be good? Especially for a second-year quarterback. Can we acknowledge that he is in that group of guys we'd be excited to have as our quarterback moving forward? Why do we have to debate whether he's better than Mahomes or Allen or Herbert? It's exhausting and it's hyperbolic. And it's not rooted in any conversation that needs to take place. So I don't understand the need to have those conversations now. Like, best case scenario, even if you're a massive Stafford fan, he's a borderline Hall of Famer. So why would anyone invite that conversation the day after he just does the best thing he's ever done? Can we just give it a minute? Let him celebrate? Appreciate the good thing he did? Why does it always have to be more? The best, better than, especially when there are so many interesting things to talk about with regard to that game, like the play calling on both sides and the strategies and the ways that OBJ's injury changed both. So let's have those conversations now with the incomparable Warren Sharp, football analytics and betting expert and consultant for NFL teams. His Sharp Football Analysis website, not only a great resource to consult before games, especially if you plan on wagering them, but as you will see today, he's really interesting to check in with after games as well. He's one of my favorites, always grounds his opinions in data and thinks to collect data that is different from others. I always learn something when we talk, and I think that you will too. One note before we get started, we did have this conversation before McVay and a shirtless and inebriated Aaron Donald hopped on the run it back train at their parade. So take that part of the conversation with a grain of salt. Maybe we should take their comments at the parade with a grain of salt too, considering the amount of alcohol that appeared to have been consumed. Anyway, let's go ahead and break the huddle.
Hurry up, let's go!
2-1, 2-1, 2. Ready? Three.
Warren, welcome. Thank you so much for making time. I know it's a busy week. This whole month is just crazy, but now it slows down, kind of, right? Because we just go into off season. How many times have you watched the game?
I obviously the first time, and then I've watched it twice since. I watched some of the stuff on the All 22, and then I rewatched the actual game copy, the condensed version of the game itself.
After the game, what is your first step in going back and creating the type of analysis that you do?
Well, the first thing is just getting access to the charting data that I love to look at, because there's so many different things that I thought going into the game were going to happen. Like the Bengals might use a lot of the rush 3 drop 8 type coverage. I wanted to know how often the Rams were blitzing Joe Burrow versus not blitzing, because I felt like they didn't need to blitz in order to get pressure and they should actually play more zone. Blitzing might open themselves up to, you know, allowing some bigger plays down the field. So I didn't want the Rams to be blitzing, because I was kind of thinking in my mind how the game would play out. Then I obviously place a lot of bets and analysis based upon that. So whether it's prop bets or regular bets, I'm betting based upon what I think is going to happen in the game after all my analysis. But so much of, you know, handicapping the games and betting on the games is you're handicapping the coaches. Will they do what you think they should do? Are they seeing the same things that you are seeing? Are they going to try the same types of things? And so you kind of handicap what you think they're going to do. You understand the matchups, and then you place your bets accordingly. So I was very curious after the fact how things went. Now, I'll be honest with you. I won a good bit of money on the game. Like, we did really well betting the game. So I was not immediately like, let me go back and rewatch this game right now, tonight. I'm just like enjoying.
You weren't in that frame of mind?
Not in that frame of mind. I'm just enjoying myself.
Popping bottles?
Popping a couple bottles. making sure I watch like a late night movie. I always love to watch like a late night movie after the Super Bowl, just to kind of like decompress as a first chance that, you know, literally since you start betting on futures in May or June of the summer, you know, the first time that you're like, I actually don't have to sweat out. There's no bets I'm worried about winning or losing. There's nothing I need to do more from a handicapping perspective. I can finally just let my brain go to mush and relax. And so that's what usually Sunday nights for me. And then Monday I get back into rewatching the game and digging into kind of like the advanced charting data.
Yeah. So one of the things that I was looking for, but cannot look for live in a game, like I just have not gotten to the point where I can train myself to not follow the ball. But so one of the things that we talked about on this podcast last week with Seth Galina from PFF was like the use of, you know, five down linemen from a Rams standpoint, whether or not they would do that or feel like they needed to do that, or whether they would go four guys up front, whether they would do two high safety or single safety, and what did the Rams end up doing defensively?
So the Rams, they actually did what I was hoping they would do, which is not really blitz a ton. They only blitzed a few times. They mainly sat back and played their coverage. And at the beginning of the game, the adjustment that the Bengals were making was they were getting the ball out really quickly from Joe Burrow's hand. I mean, the amount of times that he was throwing the ball in less than 2.5 seconds was the vast majority of his pass attempts. He was getting the ball out quickly. In the second half, what the Bengals started to do a little bit more of is hold on to the football and try to work some of the deeper concepts, which was a bad adjustment on their part. Now, the Rams, I think I've got some of the numbers. When they blitzed, the Rams only blitzed, let's see, they got good pressure when they chose to blitz, a 67% pressure rate, and got 3 sacks, but they only did it on 9 dropbacks. And when Burrow was not sacked, he had a lot of success against the Rams when the Rams were sending an extra rusher against him. He averaged 17 and a half yards per attempt, plus 0.23 EPA through his only touchdown, averaged 8.2 air yards. So threw the ball a little bit further down the field. When the Rams did not blitz him, their pressure rate obviously went down a little bit, down to 39%, but they forced Joe Burrow to throw the ball really short on this underneath stuff. So 8.2 air yards when he was blitzed dropped down to 6.1. So he's not throwing the ball as deep down the field. He only averaged 5.9 yards per attempt on these passes, had negative EPA. So his expected points per every attempt was negative. And he only had a 41% success rate through obviously 0 touchdowns. So it was a lot of the more underneath stuff that was more in line with what the Rams like to do. But the fact that they were not sending an extra rusher and still getting pressure 39% of the time, that's really what I was anticipating and hoping that they would do a little bit more of. And that was, your D-line is so much better than the Bengals O-line. And everybody knows it. I mean, if you ask anybody before the game, what is the biggest mismatch here?
Yes.
It's that singular thing. So my interest in this game was, what is Zach Taylor going to do to offset that? How is he still going to figure out a way to win despite this being the biggest single mismatch? And everybody knows it heading into the game. And the reality was, especially at the end, the way that game ended on the fourth down and every minute in between was kind of the biggest thing that everybody thought was going to be the difference ended up being the difference. And that was the pressure that the Rams were able to deliver without blitzing and still just sitting back and playing coverage absolutely messed up the Bengals passing attack. Now, they still had success running the ball. I will say, like, I went 14 and 7 in my bets on this game. And one of the bets that I lost was I didn't think Joe Mixon was going to have as good of a game as he did. I bet under his rushing yards. I think it was at like 62, 63 and a half, somewhere in that neighborhood. And I think he went over by like 10 yards. I wasn't anticipating him having quite the level of success that he did on the ground. But I do think this, Lindsay, if the Rams never lose Odell Beckham Jr., right, then I think that there's no opportunities for the Bengals to really run the ball in the second half because they're really playing from behind at that point. That single injury, you could argue Cooper Kupp won the MVP and maybe Aaron Donald should have gotten the MVP. But the reality is the guy that was making the most difference out on that field was Odell Beckham Jr. And he probably would have been the MVP, but re-tearing his ACL.
Well, and at the very least, just him being on the field, there's a big drop off from OBJ to like, okay, plug in our next guy. And I was watching the game and I know everybody was really tough on Sean McVay and I get that. But I was also sitting there wondering, this has got to be like a really tough situation for him to take Odell out and his whole game plan is set. You know, he's got ideas. It's one thing if the defense takes Odell away, then that frees up something else. That's something you can plan for in your head as a coach. The chess match just moves and you're ready for that. When you literally lift him out because of an injury, you don't have that player there. It just changes everything that you want to do. And I wondered how much he was left going like, which ones can we still run effectively? You know, how much did you see that affect what you thought Sean McVay wanted to do and could do?
Well, I think it was a big factor, especially when you look at, you know, when we're handicapping games and betting on games, you always look at the injuries from a who's the replacement guy, who's the next guy up, so to speak.
And then you value of a replacement.
Value over replacement. And you also look at the cluster injury, the cluster nature of some of these injuries. So if you're talking about, you know, your right guard and your number one, number two wide receiver, and, you know, one of your cornerbacks, these are different guys in all types of different positions. But here you already lost Robert Woods. You brought in Odell Beckham. Now you've lost Odell Beckham. Then you've lost Tyler Higbee, right? Who's your number? So we're talking about pass catchers. You've lost two wide receivers now, two of your top three on your team. Then you lose Tyler Higbee, your number one tight end. And then his backup gets injured, I think, close to halftime. And so now they're to their third string receiving tight end in the second half of the game. They're down both of these. Obviously, they know they're not playing with Woods, but just from a talent level perspective, we are dropping off a lot at the pass catcher talent level on this roster from when we started the Super Bowl to where we are now in the third quarter. It did impact them, right? We saw how many consecutive drives. I sent out a tweet during the game. I'll pull it up as we're talking here. But there was a tweet I sent about the consecutive drives. Yeah, at one point they had six straight drives. I think it started the tail end of the first half and went all the way through into the third quarter where it was punt, interception, field goal, punt, punt, punt. Right. So only 3 points on six drives. And three of those drives started at ridiculously great field position. One started 2 yards shy of midfield. One started 3 yards shy of midfield. One started 9 yards shy of midfield. And they punted every single one of those drives. It's somewhat inconceivable.
And those four drives that ended in punts that you're talking about were all three and outs.
Yes.
Every single one of them. And the interception was one play.
Exactly.
It was a one play drive. One so like drive. Just a total disaster, those drives, when you look at the, you know, put them all together.
And the frustrating thing to me, though, you know, when we talk about Sean McVay himself and his play calling, I'm never going to hate on somebody for winning a Super Bowl. I'm so happy that he won the Super Bowl. I felt like he's been so close. He's been a very good coach for so long. Like Zach Taylor will have more chances at this, hopefully for him. I do think it was kind of like a fairy tale run for the Cincinnati Bengals here. I don't know that if some people were saying before this game that like if they win this, they're set up to be a dynasty. Like the only thing I think is really ideal with them is they've got a quarterback who's playing extremely well on a rookie deal. So that's always what any team hopes for. You found your franchise quarterback, boom, and you still got a number of years of him being on this cheap rookie deal. But they still have work to be done on that team. And they had a lot of things break their way, even with that team this year, to get the results that they did, win those games in the playoffs that they did. And, you know, you can't really count on all of that stuff happening again next season. But getting back to Sean McVay for a second, the frustrating thing to me about Sean McVay was the lack of adjustments that he had from a run game perspective. Now, I remember watching him in the 2018 Super Bowl against the New England Patriots, and that his defense held New England to just 13 points on offense. And allowing your opponent to only score 13 points should keep you in that game within one score. Like, you should have a great shot at winning this game. And that game never even felt close. It was 13-3. Like they couldn't even get the game within a score. And what was happening was the pressure from the New England Patriots was getting to them too much. And they never made the adjustment, which would be to stop using 11 personnel, bring an extra tight end out there because you had lost Cooper Kupp. That was the season that Cooper Kupp had been gone for 3 or 4 weeks before the end of the regular season. They were down their best wide receiver. So why are you still just shoving another wide receiver? Why not throw an extra tight end, especially when you can't block the pass rush? Give Jared Goff a little bit more time. I think the mistake that Sean McVay made in this game is not pivoting out of the run game early.
On early downs.
Because
just every time.
It was terrible. They started the game. I've got some numbers here. On their first five first downs of the game, they had five in the first quarter. Of these five, every single one of them was a run. And these runs averaged 1.2 yards per carry, negative 0.5 for EPA, and 0% success. Not a single one of these runs produced positive expected points. They were atrocious when they were trying to run the football, and yet they never actually said, well, let's try something different. Let's get away from this. They continued to do it. And on early downs, the entirety of the game, they called 17 running back runs. They averaged 1.9 yards per carry, minus 0.53 EPA, and 18% success. And the frustrating part is like you and I and anybody at the stadium who was watching the game live could see these first down runs aren't working. And it's understandable. You know, we're going to come in with a game plan. I too believed that the running back core of Cam Akers and Sony Michel and Daryl Henderson would be able to do something against this Bengals run defense, particularly if the Bengals were playing this rush three, drop eight coverage, and they were playing a little softer, trying to prevent the passes. I believe that the Rams were going to have some success on the ground here. I believe that the Rams had gone up against brutal opposing run defenses like the San Francisco 49ers, like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, like the Baltimore Ravens. Those were like three of the top 10 run defenses that they played in the prior five games. In fact, of their prior five games to the Super Bowl, they played four run defenses that ranked top 10 in EPA allowed on early down runs in a game. And now they were going up against the Cincinnati Bengals, who on the season and the playoffs ranked dead last in allowing EPA on the ground to opposing running backs on early downs. They were the worst run defense in the NFL. So it's completely understandable that you build a game plan that's going to say, let's try to attack this a little bit, right? Early downs, let's try to run the football a little bit. Now, I'm typically, and I've done this, your podcast, a number of times, Lindsay, and I love doing it. And I've always been an advocate of throwing the ball more on early downs. But when you have a team that's so terrible defending it, you got to try to run a little bit. But when it's not working and you're standing on the sidelines and you keep calling these plays, despite the fact that your running back knows he's getting nothing here, the defense knows, hey, a run play is probably coming because all they're doing is running the football, right? And everybody's watching it at the stadium or on TV sees that these runs are not working at all. How do you not make that adjustment to say, let's use some deep play action here. They're going to think we're going to run it. Let's use some play action, have them bite on the run and throw it over the top. But they weren't even doing that. They just kept handing the ball off. It was really frustrating. And I feel like McVay himself got bailed out in some respects by Kupp catching that ball, by Matthew Stafford throwing that no look pass, by the penalty on third and goal, like everything that ended up happening so that the Rams won the game. Because I always think in big games like this, like I consult with some different teams, and one is specifically on the offensive side of the ball. And one of the things I always talk to the coaches about is if you end up losing this game from a play calling perspective, what do you think your biggest regret might have been? Like, what were you doing too much of? Like, going into this game, what are you going to try to do, but you think it might not work? And like, if you stuck with it and then you end up losing the game, what's that thing that you're going to remember back and say like, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that too much. That needs to be in the front of your mind a little bit so that when you're in the game, you could maybe adjust out of that quicker. And I feel like he entered this game thinking we're going to try to run on these first and second downs, primarily on all these first down runs. It wasn't working and they never switched out of it quickly enough.
Do you think he thought that they were wearing them down and that it just might get easier as the game went on?
That is probably the only intelligent, logical thought process that he could have for continuing to run his head into a brick wall and having no success whatsoever because
the wall will break.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, they say, what is the definition of insanity? Repeating the same thing, hoping for different conclusions. That's what we were seeing a little bit in this game. And so the only logical thing, if you, we're obviously going to say Sean McVay is not insane. So what could he have been hoping for? I think your answer there is probably the most logical of any. He thought that eventually it was going to hit home. These runs were going to pay off. Maybe he thought, like, if we do this enough, play action will work. But we know, like, data has shown us, you don't need to wait until the third quarter or the second quarter to utilize play action after you've, quote unquote, established the run. What you need to do is play action will work literally on the first play of the game. Play action is going to work because the other team knows you want to try to run the football. I mean, the Bengals, looking back at some of the numbers, they weren't crowding the box. I mean, on over half those first down runs, they were into semi-light boxes, six-man boxes, and they still weren't productive. So your O-line is not matching up well enough against their D-line. They figured out something. They know what they're doing. Even against light boxes, you're not having success. You got to pivot, and it was very frustrating.
I was surprised about that from an O-line standpoint, the Rams. I thought that the O-line would hold up better. They did not look good in that game particularly. And I was a little bit surprised by that. In terms of wearing down, it did feel like the Rams had an advantage as the game went on the other side of the ball, right? Like the defense late in particular. Hold on. I have the numbers. Okay. So the Bengals' final six drives, they had one field goal on their final six drives. And that field goal drive was an 11-yard drive after a takeaway. So there were six sacks in that period of time for the Rams on 21 dropbacks. Like, what happened as the game went on that allowed the Rams defense to have even more success? Because it kind of felt a little bit early on like the defense wasn't having the advantage that I thought that they were going to have, at least just on the surface. And then it just, like, the dam broke in the second half.
Yeah. One of the things that one of my guys pulled, Ryan McChrystal pulled for me, is that in the first half, 68% of Joe Burrow's dropbacks saw him release the ball with less than 2.5 seconds. But in the second half, only 50% saw him release the ball within 2.5 seconds. And six of his seven sacks occurred after 2.5 seconds. They were relying a little bit more. The Bengals started relying a little bit more on these slower developing routes. You know, you go back and you watch the tape of Jalen Ramsey versus Ja'Marr Chase, that matchup when those guys were on each other. And, you know, it's just brutal playing cornerback in the NFL because I want to venture to say 90% of those plays, maybe 85%, Ja'Marr Chase won, right? Like they weren't able to target Jalen Ramsey won. Jalen did a great job on his coverage. They had to go somewhere else with the football because he was doing a great job. But you have that big play down the field to start the game where he falls down. And Ja'Marr Chase makes a miracle catch. And you have that play late. It was the final 4th-and-1 at the end of the game where if Joe Burrow has a split second more, Jalen Ramsey had fallen down too. And Joe Burrow could have thrown it. And maybe it's a game-winning touchdown for the Cincinnati Bengals. But for the most part, it was the Rams' ability to generate this consistent pressure without having to send guys that eventually got the Bengals, I think, and maybe Joe Burrow to an extent, like a little bit more rattled. And instead of like calling a lot of these short underneath routes, they started trying to throw the ball a little bit deeper down the field. And there's longer developing routes when that happens. Right. And so he has to hold the ball longer. And it just, you know, the game was never out of reach. It was 13-3 at the very beginning in the second quarter, I guess. But the bang in this whole second half, it was basically a one score game. And I don't know that they needed to get as desperate as they were playing.
What do you think Zach Taylor should have done differently? Is it just as simple as like being patient, sticking with the game plan? Cause I think all of us that really looked at this kind of expected like that underneath stuff to be where they were going to live because of what we'd seen from the offensive line. And we knew Joe Burrow was going to have to get the ball out. We knew this was going to be a quick passing game for them.
Yeah, I was surprised a little bit that they weren't attacking the slot quite as much, because I felt like there was a mismatch more so there and they would have had a little bit more success with it. But it's very difficult. You know, I don't really know what the right answers were for Zach Taylor here, because your O-line is so overwhelmed by the pressure anytime that you're passing the ball. Now, they did a very good job of running the football. Like I said, Joe Mixon did end up having some success when he was running the football. So trying to remain as balanced as possible and just get the ball out of Joe Burrow's hands quickly would have been the first couple of things that I would have suggested. And I think that they tried to do that. It ultimately became a game where, I mean, the reality is, the far superior from a talent perspective team in general coaching, in my opinion, was the Rams. And the Bengals were right there with them all the way up until the bitter end. So, I mean, I can't say anything too negatively about Zach Taylor. I think it was a commendable effort to try to develop this game plan. Obviously, it stinks at the end of the day. You're going to go back and watch the film, and they're probably going to pick out a number of things beyond just mistakes that were made that, from a strategic perspective, they could have done a little bit better. And so they're going to have a long list of those, I'm sure. But for me, I just think more balance and continuing to rely on the shorter passing game would have been the best things that I could have thought. Of course, you can look at like that, the play call that they had on that third and short situation, and then the fourth down situation there at the end where they don't end up converting the first down. You also have that scenario on their very beginning of the game, where I think they turned the ball over on downs as well. Their very first drive of the game, they turned the ball over on down. So it's like certain plays in those two sequences to just try to figure out a way to get a couple of yards. I'm sure that there were a couple of plays in both of those series that he wished he had again and could have changed.
That last play by Aaron Donald, I just want to pat myself on the back, because at the Super Bowl party where I was, I called it right before the play. I'm like, this is an Aaron Donald, like, pick up Joe Burrow and slam him to the ground with an exclamation point play. That's what's coming. It wasn't quite that dramatic, but it was pretty darn close. If you take Aaron Donald off this team with these threats of retirement that are suddenly swirling, and I'm sure freaking out Les Snead, because the way that this team is built sort of depends on those stars remaining in the positions that they're in for a period of time so that his team build can kind of play out the way that he wants it to. If you take Aaron Donald off this team, how much does that mess up what they have going?
It's huge. It's a huge factor. You were, though, I want to take it back. Your prediction of that was in line with what Sean McVay was doing, because Sean McVay, they released that great video clip from NFL Films of him saying right before that play, Aaron's going to make a play here. And you were saying the exact same thing.
I mean, that's the way the movie ends, right? Like, that's the moment. Like, your star makes that play. It's just, it was aligned. It was meant to be.
Yeah, it was a storybook finish for Aaron Donald. The one thing that I was interested, you know, as we led up to the game, and I ended up being close to being wrong here. Maybe I should have been wrong here by saying that why I thought it was going to be difficult for Aaron Donald to win the MVP is that so much of what he does doesn't necessarily result in him making the tackle, but it gives the tackle to somebody else because he's occupying the extra blockers.
Three people are on him.
He's making that penetration, right? That then allows somebody else to come in behind him and make a play. He's like collapsing the one side of the line of scrimmage. So the running back has to go over there to help him pass pro. And it leaves another guy completely one-on-one coming off the other end. Like, there's just so much that Donald does that to the voters who are looking at the stat sheet might not see his actual impact. But if you could, you know, vote based upon impact in the game, not necessarily the stats, Donald should have won the MVP, in my opinion. So when you say, well, how much do they lose without Donald? It's more than just the stats he compiles. That's the beauty of what Aaron Donald brings to the table. It's how much of an easier job he allows for everybody else around him, how much the defense needs to say, if we have any chance to win this game, or the offense needs to say, if we have any chance to win this game, it can't be because of Aaron Donald. So let's figure out a way to help neutralize Aaron Donald if we can. I mean, there's nobody else on that roster that they're going to say that about, for offenses if Aaron Donald's not there. So I hope for selfish reasons, because I love watching him play and seeing what he does, that Aaron Donald is able to come back for another year. I mean, this retirement talk of like him and Sean McVay and all this stuff, like it's too much for me right now. Like, I don't want to hear, I don't want to consider all this retirement stuff like up in the air. Let's focus. If you're going to retire, like, give us a year of advance notice so that we know that this is could be the end of it for you. You know, Tom Brady all of a sudden retiring, and I still think Sean McVay is coming back. I don't think he's retiring, but you never know, I guess. I'm hoping these guys that are great players give us a more of a heads up, that so that we can have, you know, more appreciation for what they're doing in those last seasons.
I mean, I guess I get it in the sense that they put so much into what they do to do it at the level that they do it, that I can imagine it's just draining and soul sucking and all of these things. But like, they're so young. This is the youngest coach ever to win a Super Bowl. This is a 30-year-old defensive tackle. I mean, he's accomplished everything he needs to accomplish. So I guess I get that, but it just feels, it feels too soon. Like you said, the rest of us are not ready. I'm not ready.
The other thing too about Aaron Donald, like, the NFL is different now than it even was 7, 8, 10 years ago. You know, now the training camps aren't nearly as laborious. Like, the great thing that Sean McVay does that no other coach did before he got there is he's just like, I'm not playing any of my starters in the preseason. I'm not playing them in the games at all. So the training camps are more regulated. They aren't putting as much wear and tear on the players' bodies. Then he specifically doesn't ask his guys like Aaron Donald or Matthew Stafford to go and actually play in these preseason football games. They added one extra week to the season this past year, right? Mm-hmm. So that is a factor in, okay, it's more wear and tear and pounding on my body. But, you know, there is this element that you don't have to do quite as much physical in the off season. All the training and stuff still has to be there. These guys never really let their bodies get out of shape like the older guys did either. So it's a year round thing. You basically have to listen to your body and your family and make the right decisions for yourselves. And I would find that it would be difficult to pass up that amount of money when I'm playing at that elite of a level, right? Like, it's one thing if my play has declined, I'm like, I don't know, and then I'm not making quite as much money. That's a little bit easier to walk away from. But he's literally on top of the world right now in terms of a defensive player overall, specifically defensive lineman, best in the game, making and being paid like he is. I hope that we see him for a little bit longer.
I wonder if this is a negotiating thing. But it also feels like the way it's come up and all that kind of stuff, it would be so calculated to put it out when it came out. And I don't know that the person that is not cynical in me doesn't want to believe that Aaron Donald would have had that come out when it came out, if it was a negotiating tactic. That just feels weird and like amiss with the personality, I suppose.
Yeah. And now like talking about Sean McVay, you know, right, comments at first, I just believed that these were getting misinterpreted, misconstrued. A lot of people write things just to write things, you know, they'll sensationalize aspects of it. They'll try to create stories where there aren't on, and they'll hype up the stories to make it into something more than it really is. I don't know. When I initially read his quotes about, well, I'm getting married this summer, and then I'd like to have kids, and then when I've got kids, I'd like to be around for them. Like, to me, like, as a father of two myself, I'm like, okay, well, you know, just because you're getting married doesn't mean you're having a kid like the next second. Like, that's a process, right? That takes a little time to cook one of those guys and have him be born. And then it's like, okay, so I've got a 3-month-old baby. Like, that's, the baby's not really doing anything. I'm not trying to sound like, you know, funny here, but like, I thought he was talking more so about like, I want to be there to help coach my kids at sports. Right. I want to be there to be around while my kids are growing up. That's not necessarily the case with like a little baby that can't even walk or move around or do anything yet. So I kind of felt like he was talking about, it's something in the back of my mind, but it might be a few years down the road. That's what I was thinking.
It is interesting though. It feels generational, right? Like, we're seeing people who feel comfortable walking away sooner. And maybe that has to do with some of the things that you mentioned about it's a year long thing. There are no breaks. This NFL has no off season. Like, there's like maybe a couple of weeks in June where you can really unplug, But I mean, for the most part, you're still training. You're still in it. The guys like Sean McVay, they're not taking a break. They're constantly, you know, putting the different possibilities in the off season through their brain, trying to figure out and what the front office should do. Like, it's just, it's a chore, you know, it's a lot. It's even more than it used to be. And you have a lot of those coaches that used to coach. There's a lot of evidence now that, you know, it was hard for them to raise families and have good relationships. And I wonder how much of what we're seeing now comes from talking to people or observing people who did it for a very long time and just realizing, like, this generation's like, no, I don't want to, you know, be good at my career at the expense of everything else. It feels very specific to this age group, I guess.
I think there is something to that. You're absolutely right about that. What I also think that's interesting is, like, if there does become a little snowball effect of this, some of the older coaches that are still in this, you know, some of the older guys are look back and say, like, you know what, like, I kind of wish I had done that when he was doing it, or earlier in my career. Maybe some of these older guys decide it's not worth the grind. Like, is it worth the grind doing this into your, like, mid to late 60s? When if you don't actually need the money, all the stress and pressure and everything, when you could be enjoying your grandkids at those ages. So, I mean, maybe some of those guys think the same way. Although I will say this, I mean, a lot of these people, like, when you're the younger generation, like you're saying, it's a little bit different, but those older guys, this is what they think is expected of them and that right. They want for themselves too. It's like the same thing. They're in line with, like, this is who I am. If I wasn't doing this, I have no idea what I would be doing. Like, I wake up, I coach football. I wake up, I think about football. Like, I can't imagine stepping away from it. But at the end of the day, we only have one life to live, and you try to do the best with your time, because that really is the most precious commodity that we have.
And we're changing, we're shifting as a culture. Now we're getting into, like, deep, not football stuff, but it feels like it used to be that, you know, like, the women would stay home and the men would go to work. And then it was became like women started to go to work. And then that was a lot of pressure on them to try and be both things well. And now it feels like the same is true for the dads, you know, like, that pressure is also there. It's there for everybody to feel like you don't want to fail at any of it. And it's really, really hard. And I think that that's pressure that's not existed societally, like, in our history as a nation. And so it'll be interesting to see over the next few years. We've had people, I mean, you know, the Andrew Lux of the world, Patrick Willis, who stepped away. You have, I mean, for very different reasons, Luke Kuechly, but, like, people who are leaving the game earlier and making this decision to say, like, I've been paid a lot of money. I don't need to do this forever. I'm financially fine. Like, let's go have a life. I think it's an interesting off-season conversation to be had. The Bengals, you alluded to this earlier, about maybe a little bit of volatility with regard to their success this year. What specifically about that team build feels most volatile? We all know they're going to address the offensive line this offseason. I mean, knock on all of the wood around you, like, it's glaring. We're just going to go address the offensive line. But is that it? Is it as simple as that?
No, I don't think it is. Look, every time that a team has one of these Super Bowl runs, whether they win it or come in second place, just making the game, usually these are, like, the healthiest teams out there, right? Like, it's hard. It's a rare situation, like, that the Kansas City Chiefs were able to get all the way to the Super Bowl last year and were completely banged up, right? Their O-line was a total train wreck during the course of that Super Bowl. Most of the teams, in order to get that far, have had such good fortune that inevitably, and this is why there's always, like, this regression, is you're going to fall off. You're going to start having an average number of injuries. You know, like, last year, they probably had less than average. And then next year, maybe they go back to having average. And that's going to actually impact their ability to play well. I think some of the interesting things were when I was listening to the hype leading into the Super Bowl, a lot of how Super Bowl specifically, although I do this to a smaller degree for all of the games that I'm handicapping, is like, what's the public think about here? How much does the public buy into this team or that team? But for the Super Bowl, I pay close attention to, like, what the public bet splits are, who's betting on the Bengals, like, how much talk is going on publicly about how good this Bengals team is? What is the census to the Bengals offense? And a lot of what I was, obviously from a percentage perspective, the public was betting on the Bengals. I mean, I saw a poll on the NFL Network the night before the Super Bowl that was done by Reddit, where you don't get two times your money if you bet on the Bengals, right? Like a normal payout would. If you're actually placing a bet, you place a dollar, you get $1.75 back. Here, you have nothing to gain. Pick the better team. Who do you think is going to win this game? Still, 57% of the people were banking on the Cincinnati Bengals to win in the Super Bowl. A lot of people were buying into the fact that, like, Joe Burrow is elite right now on a totally different level than most other quarterbacks around the NFL were. And I'm looking back at his statistics in a lot of these playoff games, and it's really nothing to write home about. Like, they obviously you're playing against better competition, but I mean, his comeback win over the Kansas City Chiefs, one touchdown, one interception, 11 of 18, you know, 7 yards per pass attempt. Like, these weren't numbers that were like mind-boggling. Oh my God, he put his whole team on his back and brought them back to win this game against the Kansas City Chiefs. And that's how they made it to the Super Bowl. That really wasn't the case at all from a statistical perspective. I think the legend of what Joe Burrow is right now is bigger than what he actually produced. That being said, I'm not trying to be a hater at all, because I do see his future, him getting better and better and better. So I think that he does have the chance to eventually become, like, I don't even want to put him, use the names of some of the other players, because I think sometimes it's unfair. I think he can be one of the elite quarterbacks in the NFL. You know, what I love a lot about Joe Burrow is I think right now in his NFL career, in games that he started, 21 covers, only 9 ATS losses. This guy, I call him Joey Covers. He just keeps games close. If he's a dog, he finds a way to keep that game close. If he's a favorite, he figures out a way how to win this game and sometimes cover him. Like, he's had a great ATS record as a pro. So you love backing a guy like that. And I think he's a total stud. So I think he's going to get better. But they have such a great receiving core right now. And I think the fun part about this team is where they could go offensively from here. Also, Lou Anarumo, highly underrated. I'll admit this myself. I failed to realize the level and frequency of adjustments that this guy makes in game and the complicated nature of his defense. I kind of didn't envision it was going to be this way. But as you're studying them more, as they go through their playoff run, I'm getting more and more impressed with how he is calling this defense. And how much better they were to finish the year than they were even like in week 10, 11, 12, 13 of the season. Right? I know they play, you can only play who you're playing, but you're not playing that many great offenses. But he ended up getting this team to perform so much better down the stretch. So he's going to be there. What really needs to improve the most though, Lindsay, for me is still Zach Taylor. Zach Taylor needs to improve from a play calling, from an offensive design perspective, because if he didn't have, it's crazy to think this, but if he didn't have a good year this year, if you look back at what he had done the prior several years, it might have been his last year. He literally saved his job as head coach of the Cincinnati Bengals with this run that his team went on this season, because prior to this, there was a lot of question marks surrounding him. This was a team that was supposed to only win 6 to 6.5 games based on the preseason Vegas odds heading into the season. They were supposed to finish dead last in the AFC North. They win the AFC North. They obviously win a lot more than 6, 6.5 games. They win the AFC. They make it to the Super Bowl. A lot of that is variance, positive injury, health, ability to win close games, Joe Burrow being a stud, their receivers and having a lot of talent. They need an offensive line, as you mentioned. And I think they need more from a play calling perspective from Zach Taylor. But he has shown us that he's capable of delivering on that because of what the job that he did this year. So we just want to see more of that development this upcoming year.
I saw somebody make the comparison, and maybe it was you, that said, like, for he was Goff to, like, in the comparison, it was Sean McVay and Goff, right? Like, Goff was holding back Sean McVay a little bit. Yep. They could still make it work, but like, he was the weaker link. And in this case, Burrow is Goff. Burrow is McVay.
Yes.
And he's the Goff in this scenario potentially.
Yeah. I mean, Burrow is the stud here. Burrow is the guy who can basically do whatever needs to be done. And you just need that play caller to elevate himself to be great, just like Joe Burrow is. Absolutely.
Okay, last question. I've taken way more time than I told you I was going to, so I apologize about that.
Okay.
Next year's Bengals. Do you have a guess as to who might be that team that comes out of nowhere? Is anyone built in such a way where, you know, we might not be expecting them? This is your call your shot moment.
Let me go back and look here.
Okay.
I'm going to give me a second. I got to pull up all the teams and start thinking about it. Well, I will say this. I looked up all the futures odds for 2022, and I am shocked that the Cincinnati Bengals have the fourth best odds, Lindsay, Whoa. To win the Super Bowl next year. I just think that this was like a very much of a fairy tale type run for them. The AFC is brutal. I mean, I could say like, this is a guy, maybe I'll end up mentioning this team, but Justin Herbert, right? Justin Herbert is one of my favorite quarterbacks in the NFL. That team has to be significantly better next season. I know they had a first-year head coach in there, and there were some growing pains along the way and some questionable decisions and those types of things. Like, but that team is built to make potentially a run. But see, that team, I would be cheating if I threw them into the mix, right, Lindsay, because they're not a team that's supposed to only win six games next year and finish in last place, right? They have a lot better upside. But the point is that you've got Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, Justin Herbert, Lamar Jackson, all of these guys. I'll take too long to pull up this tweet, but I went through and listed the five best quarterbacks from the AFC and the five best quarterbacks from the NFC in no particular order. The AFC quarterbacks were all like 26 years old and younger, and the NFC quarterbacks were all 28 years old and older. And that was
Who even are they in the NFC? So now Brady's gone, and Aaron Rodgers. We don't know where Rodgers is going. So
right, it was Aaron Rodgers. It was like Dak Prescott was in the mix, I think. Kyler Murray was just on the outside of it. But it's not even close to the level of competition between AFC and NFC. That's why I think, for example, Brian Daboll going to become a head coach but choosing the NFC instead of the AFC could be a wise decision there, because this AFC is going to be very difficult to win. And so imagine, like, you're the Bengals. You love your team. You love your quarterback. But in order to go to the Super Bowl again next year, you're going to have to somehow get by Patrick Mahomes, get by Josh Allen, get by Lamar Jackson, like all these other, get by Justin Herbert.
Get by Herbert, yeah.
It's going to be very difficult to do that. I'll throw this out there. I don't think that the prediction is right. I'm going to obviously go with the team from the NFC. I'm going with the team from the NFC because it would be foolish not to. We just talked about all these great quarterbacks in the AFC. It's going to be an easier path in the NFC this year. So figure out in the NFC. And if I want to pick a team that has like odds that are in the bottom eight in the NFL, I might go with the New York Giants. I might go with the New York Giants. And here's why. I think that they are a team that was better than what their record has shown. I'm going to go with the team that I think has had poor coaching for several years there. And I'm going to go with the team that has enough draft capital. Like maybe I'll be wrong because they stick with Daniel Jones, and Daniel Jones has a limited ceiling. I think Brian Daboll is about to get a lot more out of Daniel Jones than what he's delivered previously, but that ceiling still is somewhat limited in my estimation. I don't see Daniel Jones becoming anything close to like Josh Allen, right? And so I don't see him making that level of a jump that's going to take this team into the postseason and make a run into the playoffs like we just saw from Joe Burrow. If they went out and drafted, though, a rookie quarterback with the rest of that team and the way that they might be able to build around that, and if that guy was ready to come in and play midway through the season, I think that would be an awesome situation, because I like the talent of their receivers on that roster. But it's really hard because a lot of these, you know, if you think about Joe Burrow, he was a second-year quarterback coming back from injury, and he played really well when he was playing as a rookie. And that receiving core was completely stacked. I mean, you looked at that receiving core when they added Chase, that core was stacked. They just didn't have an O-line, and they were able to make it work. I continue to believe, though, the way that you're best at picking these types of long shots, don't sit here and say, can this team win a Super Bowl? Don't sit here and like throw those lofty aspirations there. Rather, can this team make the playoffs? Because once you're in the playoffs, anything goes. Throw all the records out. I could sit here and say the Bengals maybe should have lost to the Raiders. the Bengals probably could have lost to the Tennessee Titans. Tennessee had the ball in a tie game with a minute 47 left, driving to try to kick a game-winning field goal, and they had to punt the ball. You know, they didn't convert there. The Kansas City Chiefs were up, 21-3 against the Cincinnati Bengals. So there are so many different ways that, you know, they came back and had this magical run. So anytime, for bettors out there, when you're looking to try to predict teams that could go on a run, make something happen, you'll never pick a long shot like this. If you say, can they win the Super Bowl? Are they good enough? Because none of these teams appear to be good enough, but you have to go after the teams. Can they just win 9 or 10 games this year, somehow sneak their way into the postseason? Are they capable of doing that? If they can, maybe they've got a chance, especially this year in the NFC. I firmly believe the NFC is so wide open that just get into that tournament.
And seemingly always in the NFC East. Warren Sharp, you are the best. I love talking football with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lindsay.
Love talking to Warren. He's also a great follow on Twitter, @SharpFootball. And there are links to his websites and other employers there. As for this show, now that we're in the off season, we're going to scale back to a once a week format. Let it breathe a little bit. So our next show will be next week, and it will be with Brad Spielberger from PFF. He's a salary cap expert for them. He also contributes to overthecap.com, wrote a book with Jason Fitzgerald from Over the Cap called The Drafting Stage. And he is going to join us to break down for us the right way to evaluate offseason capital, in what ways cap space can and cannot be worked around by teams, and who the teams are that are set up nicely to take big leaps forward this offseason. That is coming up midweek next week, and I hope that you'll join us for that. For now, if you would be so kind as to leave a 5-star rating and a review, that would be awesome. Also, if you could subscribe to Apple Podcasts, subscribe to the show, rather, on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Pandora, wherever you get your podcasts. The NFL Roadshow can also be found on the SXM app, free for most subscribers. Just download it today, tap the podcast, there our show will pop up. For video clips of the show and more, follow me on Twitter, Lindsay_Rhodes. I'm also on Instagram, LindsayRhodesNFL. The NFL Roadshow is part of the SiriusXM Podcast Network. The executive producer is Andrew Emmer, and a special thanks to SiriusXM's Senior Vice President of Sports Programming and Podcasting, Steve Cohen. Have a good one, everybody.
SiriusXM Podcasts.